And good afternoon. I'm still not used to this. I'm still not used to this new board. Welcome to Lambda Weekly. I'm Dave Taffet, and I'm here in the studio with Patty Fink. Welcome back, Patty.
Thank you.
Patty's with us just this week, and then you're going back to New Orleans to take care of your father-in-law.
Right after the show.
Yeah, Patty's been, and we've been saying that, Patty's been taking care of Aaron's father while he's been sick for the last few weeks.
She has two.
And she's down there, too. Yeah, Aaron is down there. Our guest today, we're real excited, is Kevin Jennings. And his new book is One Teacher in Ten in the New Millennium, LGBT Educators Speak Out About What's Gotten Better and What Hasn't. Kevin is the founder of GLSEN. He was Assistant Deputy Secretary of the Department of Education for the Office of Safe and Drug-Free Schools. He's now the Executive Director of the ARCUS Foundation. Kevin, welcome.
Oh, it's delightful to be on the radio with you. Thanks for having me.
We're delighted to have you. I just wanted to say, ARCUS Foundation, did Kathy Renna found ARCUS Foundation, or she worked with ARCUS for a while?
Kathy has worked with us. We were actually founded by John Stryker, who is one of the heirs to the Stryker medical fortune, and he decided to take his extraordinary good luck and put it to work trying to make the world better for other human beings and for animals. So we focus on conservation and human rights. Our conservation focus is great ape conservation, and our human rights focus is LGBT equality.
And the reason I'm even asking, Kathy used to come down to Dallas all the time, and she used to crash our show. I can't tell you how many times. I was going to say, if she's still working there at all, if you see her, say hi to her for us.
And she hasn't crashed her show in a while.
Yeah, she hasn't.
She needs to come down and do that.
Kathy's awesome. She's an old friend.
Good. And say hi to her for us. Let's just start talking about your book a little bit. One Teacher in Ten. It's about LGBT educators. This isn't the first in this series.
No, this is actually the third edition. I did the first edition back in 1994. And 1994 was a very, very different time. It's hard for us sometimes to even remember how different it was. You know, a third of the states in America, including Texas, still had sodomy laws back then. And the idea of out teachers was, you know, unheard of. Mm-hmm. You know, teachers have lived forever under the don't ask, don't tell policy. The fact is, LGBT teachers have always existed, but the condition of having the job was keeping your mouth shut. So when I did the first edition in 1994, what I was really doing was trying to create a space and a voice where LGBT teachers could simply say that we existed. Mm-hmm. I was at the time a high school history teacher in Concord, Massachusetts. Fast forward 20 years, and this is the third edition, and it's amazing how much things have changed and not changed. And what I mean by that is when we did the first edition in 94, we barely could find enough teachers to fill a book. Mm-hmm. And many of them used pseudonyms or disguised themselves in other ways because they didn't feel comfortable being known as an LGBT teacher.
Sure.
20 years later, the vast majority of people in the book are out. So that's a big change. And the book is much more diverse. Over half the contributors are people of color, trans people, or people from outside the United States. Whereas in the original, there were no trans people, no people from outside the United States, only one teacher of color. All of that is the good news. The bad news is it still continues to be a difficult time for LGBT teachers. Mm-hmm. As you know, obviously, 29 states still do not protect people from discrimination based on sexual orientation or gender identity, including Texas. So teachers feel very vulnerable. But what was interesting to me was the three nightmare stories in the book come from three places you would never expect. New York City, Oregon, which mm-hmm. has an openly bisexual governor.
And that was one of the stories that I was going to ask you about, because that is such an outrageous story.
Yeah, we'll go into that. That's a story written by a teacher named Brett Bigham. Mm-hmm. Brett was named last year the Teacher of the Year in Oregon. He works with severely disabled young people. And he was the first special education teacher and the first out LGBT teacher to ever get that award. And the school system responded really terribly. They actually placed a gag order on him, saying he couldn't talk publicly about being LGBT. And in the book, the story kind of stops midstream because we finished the book several months ago. since then, Brett has actually left the system and made a settlement with them.
Good.
Because it became impossible for him to continue to work there.
Mm-hmm.
So it's kind of shocking to think that here in 2015, in a place like Oregon, which, like I mentioned, has an openly bisexual governor, we're still seeing LGBT teachers forced out of their jobs.
That's amazing. I mean, it really is in Oregon, of all places.
Well, where was the school system?
Portland.
Oh, it was Portland. That's even worse. Okay. I was thinking it was like some eastern Oregon city, Portland. Okay, yeah.
The interesting thing about the book, so the third nightmare story comes from the Netherlands, which was the first country to have same-sex marriage.
Mm-hmm.
And I think what I learned from editing this book, you know, I was able to meet teachers who were out of the closet in places that you don't think of as being very welcoming to gay people, like North Carolina, which is where I'm from, or South Africa or China. And then meet teachers who were fighting for their jobs in places like the Netherlands or Oregon. And it taught me that we like to think there are certain places that are safe and mm-hmm. certain places have the monopoly on bigotry, but that's just not the fact. You know, there's bigotry everywhere, and they're accepting people everywhere.
Mm-hmm.
And I think when people ask me, what seems to make the difference in a school, the number one thing seems to be the support of the principal. When the principal and the administration is on board, there's no problem. But if the principal and the administration are not on board, then it can be very, very difficult to be an LGBT teacher, even in a place like Portland, Oregon.
Mm-hmm. Well, we have quite a history here. In fact, one of the sustaining stories of our community was when the superintendent of schools, the president of the school board, kind of did a witch hunt for LGBT people.
Originally he had said gay people are not welcome in our schools, but we couldn't have more than one or two gay teachers.
Exactly.
In Dallas.
Dallas.
Fourth largest school system, second largest school system in Texas, fourth largest metropolitan area in the country. Oh, they couldn't be more than two or three gay teachers.
And there were hundreds that were concerned.
there was
an early fight in our community.
There were dozens and dozens in several particular schools that were concerned. In fact, our high school for the arts probably would not have had a staff anymore.
Truly.
Well, the funny thing about this is, you know, I was a history teacher, so I got my start. And this is an age-old story. The best way to try and panic people against a minority is to say they're after your kid.
Mm-hmm.
You know, supposedly Jews drank the blood of Christian children in the Passover mm-hmm. Seder. Supposedly black men were after little white girls.
Mm-hmm.
And supposedly LGBT people are recruiting people to be gay. It's an old myth that gets rolled out whenever there's a new minority group that somebody wants to demonize or marginalize, is to try and convince people that they're after your kids, because if people think you're after their kids, they get very upset.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, LGBT teachers, you go back to the Briggs Initiative in California in the late 70s, which was Harvey Milk's great mm-hmm. victory. That would have banned the employment of gay people in the school system in California.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And Harvey Milk partly became famous by defeating that initiative. So, you know, this isn't new. We see this kind of nonsense. We've seen it for decades, and unfortunately, we continue to see it still.
Is this something, Kevin, in your journeys and conversations around the world that we see elsewhere as well? Do they go after, you know, the myths of you know, chasing your kids in school? And is that the way other countries are experiencing that kind of bigotry as well?
It definitely occurs. Like I mentioned, one of the stories in the book is from the Netherlands, where a story of a gay man who was fired from his job and had to fight to get it back. So it definitely happens in other countries. There's a really unique role, though, that the American education system plays. In most countries, education is seen as very kind of technical. You go to school, you get your grades, you pass your exams, that's it. In America, we expect our schools to do a lot more than that. We view them as places where kids kind of learn character values, citizenship values, and civic values. For example, in other countries, they don't really have school sports teams or extracurricular clubs.
Mm-hmm.
So schools play a much more central role in the life of young people in America, probably more than in most countries. And that's why it's so important that they be places that are accepting and supportive, because you know, what basically young people are learning in schools today is how to behave in society tomorrow.
Mm-hmm.
And if they learn that it's okay to persecute or be bigoted against people because of who they are, then they're going to grow up and vote for Donald Trump.
Mm-hmm.
So it's important that they learn the values of acceptance young, because if not, our democracy basically can't function, because it's built on the idea of respect for people who are not like each other. And that's a lesson. I always say schools should teach 4 R's, reading, writing, arithmetic, and respect.
Mm-hmm.
And unfortunately, in schools where there's bigotry against LGBT people, which is far too many of them, that the 4th R doesn't get taught.
Mm-hmm. It was interesting when we were fighting for an anti-bullying bill to go through the legislature. The one thing I think we weren't prepared for was the argument that seemed to be, you're taking away my kid's right to bully your kid. And it was framed almost, especially by some of these right-wing extremist churches, it was framed as if this was almost their right. We can bully your kid. Your kid doesn't have the right to stop my kid from bullying him.
Well, I think you're actually characterizing it exactly right. That somehow they feel that being told they have to treat people with respect is abrogating their rights,
mm-hmm.
taking their rights away, which I find completely bizarre.
Mm-hmm.
Two interesting things about that. We, when I was at GLSEN, worked with the Christian Educators Association, which represents the fundamentalist teachers in America, and we actually were able to come out with a joint agreement around how schools should address LGBT issues. And one of the cornerstones of it was, you can't ask for your kid something that you would not want every other kid in the school to have.
Mm-hmm.
So if you want your kid to be safe from bullying, then you have to agree that every other kid has the right to be safe from bullying.
Mm-hmm.
And I think when you phrase it that way, we're able to get out of this kind of gays versus Christians thing that people like Tim Davis want to put us in.
But it's almost like you have to...
It really isn't gays versus Christians. It's about whether or not every kid has a right to be safe while they're at school.
But can't we translate that to society at large? I mean, that's what the Kim Davises of the world want to do to adults. I mean, they want
Absolutely.
Their right to bully. They want their right to bully, and you don't get your right, like, mm-hmm. to marry or to get a marriage certificate from the same place everybody else gets one. You know, it's to me, it's all the same thing. It's mm-hmm. adult bullying, and there's bullying in schools.
You know,
it's all kind of the same thing.
I think learning to bully in schools, basically, schools are the training ground for the bullies of mm-hmm. tomorrow.
Sure,
yeah.
And if we don't interrupt that cycle when kids are young, then surprise, surprise, guess what? They turn out to be bullies when they're adults, too.
Mm-hmm. You know, it doesn't really surprise me, though, that a Christian group could join together with a group like GLSEN to come out with a joint statement, because I would think Christians don't want to be bullied either. They don't want to be marginalized for who they are or for their beliefs, and they shouldn't be.
I completely agree. No kid should be bullied for any reason while they're at school. What was interesting, we also did a study when I was at GLSEN, and we surveyed several thousand high school students, and we actually asked them, who gets bullied the most in your school? And the number one category, probably no surprise to anyone on this call, mm-hmm. was physical appearance. Kids mm-hmm. who were too tall, too fat, too thin, too whatever.
Mm-hmm.
The number two category, and keep in mind, this is a general population survey of high school students, not of LGBT students. The number two category was sexual orientation.
Mm-hmm.
And the number three category was gender expression.
Mm.
So categories like religion came in very, very far down the list.
Mm-hmm.
So one of the things that I find frustrating sometimes in the dialogue is you'll find some of these right-wing Christians say, well, our kids are being bullied, too.
Mm-hmm.
Well, statistically, that's not actually true.
Mm-hmm.
Two of the top 3 reasons kids are getting bullied is sexual orientation and gender identity.
Mm-hmm.
So bullying is not distributed evenly. Kids with disabilities, kids who are LGBT, they're much more likely to be bullied than anybody else.
Mm-hmm.
And those are the kids we need to focus our efforts on.
Sure, sure. But it doesn't bother me if Christian kids are saying, well, our kids shouldn't be bullied either. Maybe that's how they can relate to gay kids being bullied, by understanding, well, we could be bullied too for our beliefs, and they're being bullied just for who they are.
Well, that was what was great with working with the Christian Educators Association. They were able to find common ground with us at GLSEN and see that it wasn't about, like, gay versus Christian. It was about, hey, every kid should be able to go to school and get an education.
Right, sure.
And the fact that remains controversial in parts of this country blows my mind.
Mm-hmm.
Because the whole reason we were the first country in the world to establish a public school system was because we believed everybody had a chance to get an education and everybody should have a chance to fulfill their potential, that we were not going to be an aristocracy like Europe.
Sure.
And so when people believe that certain people can be bullied or marginalized in school and that that's okay, what they're basically doing is betraying the whole purpose of a public school system.
Sure.
Exactly.
We're talking to Kevin Jennings. He's the founder of GLSEN. He's the editor of the new book, One Teacher in Ten in the New Millennium. LGBT educators speak out about what's gotten better and what hasn't. Kevin, stick with us. We just need to take a short break. We'll be back with more Lambda Weekly right after this.
This is Lewis from UT Arlington, and I listen to Lambda Weekly podcasts at lambdaweekly.com.
And welcome back to Lambda Weekly. I'm Dave Taffet here in the studio with...
I'm Michael from UNT, and I listen.
Okay. I need to explain to Kevin. Kevin, this is our third week in a new studio. Our technology has gone... into this century, actually, for the first time for us. And some of us who are, kind of electronically challenged, this board is much bigger than our old one, and there are a lot more buttons. So,
you're talking to someone who erased his thesis from the computer 2 days before it was due.
I love you.
Oh, that's painful to even think about.
Oh, gosh.
Yeah, it's pretty bad.
We're talking about Kevin's new book, One Teacher in Ten in the New Millennium. Talking about bullying, I do want to mention you were Assistant Deputy Secretary of the Department of Education, and you headed the Office of Safe and Drug-Free Schools. And when you were appointed, boy, did that... make the news, because you would think that God knows who was coming to destroy our schools.
Yeah, it was pretty intense. My first day in Washington, there was a full-page ad in the newspaper asking that I be fired. And then Sean Hannity and Fox News led a month-long smear campaign against me that eventually culminated in about 65 Tea Party Republicans introducing a special resolution into Congress asking for me to be fired. I will say that I have the resolution framed in my office. I figure how often people get their own congressional resolution.
That's so awesome. That's a keeper for life. That's awesome.
Okay, here's what I kind of thought about it. If you have an office of civil rights, generally you'd want somebody who's affected by those civil rights. Probably an African American would head that office. If you have an office for safe schools, you'd want somebody with experience working on safe schools, but who's been affected by schools not being safe. Yes? Is that just logic?
Absolutely. And that's why the secretary and the president made it clear that under no circumstances was I ever going to be fired. The secretary said, Kevin is uniquely qualified to lead this effort.
Mm-hmm.
And I spent 2 years in the administration with the specific responsibility of creating a national anti-bullying program. And that program is still ongoing. You can check it out at stopbullying.gov.
Mm-hmm.
And we conducted a major summit in the White House, which the president keynoted in 2011.
In Dallas.
Helping people understand how to address bullying in their schools.
Yeah, and there was a big White House conference here in – it wasn't in Dallas. It was in Arlington, which is right between Dallas and Fort Worth, that the Attorney General attended. He was the keynote here. That was what got our bullying legislation in place. And we have a pretty good anti-bullying bill here in Texas and had it before a number of other big states.
What was really interesting was the day Sean Hannity came after me, I actually was leaving my office because, you tend to work late when you're in the administration.
Mm-hmm.
So he comes on around 8 o'clock or so, and my best friend texted me and said, "Say, hey, how are you doing?" I'm like, "I'm great, Philip. How are you?" He goes, "Really? You're okay? Have you watched the news today?" And I'm like, "No, I don't usually watch Fox News."
Mm-hmm.
He said, "Turn on your television." And I turned on my television, and there's Sean Hannity with my picture talking about how horrible I am.
Mm-hmm.
And I was kind of stunned, and I went home that night. My partner was living in New York, and I was living in Washington. because I had moved for this job. And I called him, and he said, I'll be damned if you went down there to fight bullying, and we're going to let you get bullied out of your job. Mm-hmm. So it was really interesting to be brought down by the president to address the issue of bullying and to immediately become the victim of bullying at the same time.
Yeah, it's pretty... It's kind of ironic. Yeah.
So your office has made our country safe and free from drugs and bullying, yes?
Well, what I'd hate to say is part of the reason I left the administration in 2011 was the Republicans cut all funding for the program. Mm. And I remember in my exit interview talking with a congressional staffer, because one of the things that I was in charge of was school shootings. And I was very lucky that there were no major school shootings during my 2 years there. Hmm. And this Republican person was congratulating me on that. And I said, I just got lucky. It's only a matter of time until the next school shooting happens.
Sure.
You guys have done not only done nothing to prevent it, you, by cutting the funding for this program, have made it more likely to happen. And I have to say, one of the things I am sorriest about in my life is that I can say I told you so.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Look at shootings in places like Newtown, Connecticut, mm-hmm. Where all those elementary school children were killed.
Sure.
It's just disgusting mm-hmm. that there actually is no longer an office of safe schools in the U.S. Department of Education, because the Republicans thought it wasn't worth spending the money on.
Hmm. And I don't think they really see the connection. And there's a huge connection between bullying that's permitted, not only from student to student, but from staff to student, from faculty to student, from faculty to faculty and staff. I mean, it's in many places, bullying is rampant. Mm-hmm. And, you know, when people want to take out something, some anger on somebody else, if they've got a gun, then it becomes a school shooting.
Mm-hmm.
Yep. Well, I mean, there's two factors at work here. First of all, the completely ridiculous situation where it's much easier to get a gun in this country than to get a car.
Mm-hmm.
You know, one of the things I was also asked to deal with when I was in administration was the issue of youth suicide. One of the things I pointed out was that 50% of youth suicides are committed with guns. That if people took pills, we could at least have a chance of getting them to a hospital and saving them.
Mm-hmm.
But if they shoot themselves, we don't.
Right.
The second thing about it is, you know, I grew up in North Carolina, as I mentioned, and my mama would always say when people behaved in predictably bad ways, she'd say, what do you expect from a pig but a grunt? and when you look at a lot of the Congress people who were behind cutting all the funding for safe schools and who are behind blocking common sense gun legislation that would keep guns out of the hands of people who want to use them for bad purposes, they are, in fact, bullies.
Yep.
So, you know, I mean, they learned as a kid that it was okay to bully people they didn't like, and they've now brought it to Washington. And they are the best advertisement possible for why we need anti-bullying programs in schools.
And I just wanted to ask, it's kind of off what we're talking about. It was safe and drug-free schools. What kinds of initiatives went on about drug-free schools?
Well, that was very interesting. The first week I was on the job, I came in and looked at the drug-free program. And the main initiative of our predecessors in the Bush administration had been drug testing for kids in schools.
Hmm.
And I said, that's not how we're going to go. So what we focused instead on was what we call protective factors, which are things that make it less likely a kid will get into drugs and alcohol. One of them, for instance, we developed a program called Safe and Supportive Schools, and we actually asked the kids what they thought about their schools. And there were basic questions like, I feel like I belong here. I feel like there's an adult I could talk to if I need somebody.
Hmm.
And what we did was put the funding into the schools where the kids said there were the biggest problems. What our predecessors did was if there was a school that was deemed to be persistently dangerous, they actually cut the funding. But that was completely backwards. You need to put the funding into the places where the problems are. So the Safe and Supportive Schools program was rolled out to 11 states and was highly effective, partly because if you ask kids, they'll tell you the truth about their schools.
Mm-hmm.
And once again, it was one of the things the Republicans cut the funding for in 2011, and so that program no longer exists. But I really found around the drug-free thing that it was, we emphasized two things. First of all, increasing the protective factors for kids so that they would feel like somebody cared about them and valued them. and they wouldn't turn to self-medication, which is what a lot of kids are doing when they take drugs and alcohol. And the second thing we focused on was recovery programs. One big problem for teenagers who have substance abuse problems is they go through treatment, then they go back to their own schools where all the kids they used to use with are still there, and they relapse immediately. So we helped support an initiative called Recovery High Schools, and these are high schools for kids in recovery where they not only get an education, but they get wraparound support services to help them remain sober. And this was a really successful program, which has been piloted in a number of states now. So I think that the, let's face it, we all know the war on drugs has failed. All it's done is led to mass incarceration. It's done nothing to solve the problem. We need a new paradigm, and that's part of what I and the other folks working in the administration were trying to bring about.
And closed down, obviously, because no funding. I have one thing that I would have done differently. You said not take money from schools that are failing, but give it to schools that are failing, not the ones that are successful. I'd give money to the schools that are failing, but I'd give more money also to the schools that are successful and let them be more successful.
Well, I...
That's just me, though.
Me, it should not, well, I agree. It should not be an either-or. It should be a both-and.
Right.
The fact of the matter is schools are so underfunded in this country that it's embarrassing.
Right.
We claim we care about kids, but as Barney Frank once put it, he said, when it comes to Congress, I think most of their concern starts at conception and ends at birth. Because we don't spend money on kids, and if we supposedly care about them, why don't we fund our schools better, all of them?
Right.
I don't understand why in this country, when we could solve so many issues, if we made the job of being an educator as important, and I mean
as a doctor.
As a doctor, as anybody else, but that salary bump as well. You know, if you could, you know, make $100,000 in teaching in a elementary school or a junior high in any given community across the country, and the competition for those spots would be so high, and we would have some real quality, and the whole idea of teaching kids would be elevated. And we could solve so many problems that occur in children who will become adults.
You know, I couldn't agree more. I was really lucky. I was the first of 46 first cousins in my family to get a college degree. And because education had such an impact on my life, I decided to become a teacher. And I was very lucky. I got to go to Harvard University on a scholarship. And I became a teacher, and I was at my reunion, my 10th reunion from Harvard, and I ran into a classmate who said, "So, Kevin, what are you doing?" I said, "Oh, I teach high school." And I said, "What are you doing?" He said, "I'm vice president of marketing for Quaker Oats." I thought that sounds very impressive. I said, "Congratulations." And he said, "Really, Kevin, you went to Harvard and you became a teacher." And
I took it and went to the White House. I hope
a little bit of a smart ass, you might have figured out during the interview. So I looked at him and I said, "Yeah, John, you're right. I spend my days helping young people achieve their potential and feel good about themselves and achieve their dreams. And you spend your days convincing people to eat more oatmeal. I'm sure your life is more fulfilling than mine."
Right, right.
But boy, that is the attitude, you know. But I know it's been 30 years, but you know, my first year of teaching, I made $12,000. My classmates who went into banking and other things were making four, five, six, seven times that much.
And it's like the lowest rung on the totem pole is a teacher, and it should be the highest one.
Yeah.
You know? Well, you know what's really interesting is you look at other countries. When I was born in 1963, America was number one in the world for the percentage of people going to college. And basically, our percentage has not changed for 50 years. Meanwhile, other countries are racing by us, like South Korea. Well, you know what's interesting about South Korea? Teachers there are paid 50% more than the median salary for a college graduate. Teachers in America are paid below the median for salaries for college graduates. Gosh, maybe that's why South Korea has almost 60% of their young people going to college, whereas we only have about 30-35.
Yeah,
it's insane. There's so much potential laying on the table. You know, it's just shocking and sad.
So you left the Department of Education. Frustrated or?
I felt in the end that we were able to get some really good stuff done. But I came to the conclusion that without the financial resources we needed, we had done as much as we could.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and that was the sad part, which was that we simply didn't have the financial resources we needed to do the work that needed to be done.
Mm-hmm.
And that was a political decision made in Congress by a Republican majority that basically didn't really care about the safety of young people.
Right. Just to give you a little thing about what's going on here in Texas, we have a new governor this year, and he put on the Texas Board of Education a homeschooler who is now the head of the Texas Board of Education.
Well, you know, I think in the end, a lot of these folks don't even think public schools should exist.
Right.
That they would like to do things like voucher programs where you take your tax money and you can send your kid to a religious school if you want. They don't fundamentally care about public schools.
Mm-hmm.
And like I said earlier, that's incredibly ironic because in some ways our democracy is founded on public schools. They were the engine that was supposed to give everybody an opportunity to achieve in a country so that we would not be one where your zip code determines the course of your life.
But aren't public schools just kind of a little bit communist?
Yeah, funny how what seemed to make sense in the 1800s now gets called communist in the 21st century, huh?
Yeah.
But, you know, it's a sad moment because I really think that access to the American dream is growing more and more and more narrow in this country. And a big part of that is the disinvestment in the public school system that's occurred. If you look at, for instance, state universities, tuitions have skyrocketed over the last 30, 40 years because legislatures have cut the subsidies to those universities. So they basically have shifted the burden onto the shoulders of students who are now graduating with such incredible amounts of debt that they can't even think about doing a profession like teaching because they can't afford to. So it becomes a vicious circle where, you know, education becomes more and more expensive, fewer and fewer people can access it, and we just continue to spiral downwards. And the thing that I want any conservative listener to think right now, should you have one or two, is that this is bad for the economy.
Mm-hmm.
We will not remain the number one economy in the world if countries like South Korea are graduating twice as many people from college as we are. Those countries will overtake and surpass us, and they're in the process of doing that right now. And that's because they are investing in education. They are investing in developing an educated workforce that is ready for the 21st century. We are disinvesting in education. And you can only do that for so long before it catches up to bite you in the butt.
One generation.
Exactly. And, you know, I look at my my family story. My family's from Appalachia. My mother had a sixth grade education. My father had a 10th grade education. And they worked hard and they sacrificed, and I was able to go to university. I look at my husband's family. He's from Ohio. His dad only had a 9th grade education, but he worked in a Ford motor plant in a unionized job, and he was able to put 6 kids through college with those wages. Well, those jobs are gone now, and the next generation is really starting to struggle. Because the opportunities, the government programs like the GI Bill, for instance, which subsidize the whole generation of people getting their college educations, those investments have gone by the wayside so we could have more tax cuts for the rich.
Mm-hmm.
And stories like mine and my partner's, which were once the normal story in America, like poor kid makes it from small town in North Carolina and gets to go to Harvard, are increasingly rare.
You know, for me, I grew up just outside New York City. Going to college, it wasn't even a discussion of will I go to college. It was a discussion of will I stay home and go to college or am I going away to college? That was the discussion. And my school had something like a 95% graduation rate and something like 80%, 85% went on to college. The school now is closed and has been reopened. It was taken over by the state because it was a failed school where the graduation rate was down to 80%, which in Texas actually would have gotten it an exemplary rating, but it was down to 80%, but the number going to college was down to 60 or something like that. It's sad what in one generation has happened.
Yeah, I mean, it is. You look at even more disastrous systems like Detroit, where only 20 to 25% of kids are even graduating from high school, period. And in a global economy where information is everything, what you're basically doing is consigning entire generations and entire communities to poverty. Because if you don't have basic education, there's no way you're going to be able to get good jobs in the information economy. So when we tolerate a situation like we have in Detroit, where 20 to 25% of kids is the graduation rate, we're basically saying we're just consigning all of you to be poor for the rest of your life. Let's call it what it is. We basically are writing off entire communities and saying we don't care if you're poor for the rest of your life.
And isn't it funny that we're the ones saying, no, education is important because it's the cornerstone of our whole economy. And it's people like us left-wing liberals here, who are saying that. And conservatives and people in business aren't saying that. Why?
Well, I actually think a lot of people in business actually are saying that.
I hope so.
I think a lot of people in business are very concerned. Like, I live in New York City now, and I'll tell you kind of an interesting thing. The chief executive of one of the big drugstore chains actually came to the New York City Public Schools and said, we want to partner with you. And they were very excited, and they said, well, why? What got you interested? He said, because we can't find cashiers who know how to make change. So I think there are a lot of business leaders who are recognizing that there's a real problem here. The political leaders seem to be the ones who are behind the times.
Yeah.
You know, it goes back to the age-old argument about taxes, school taxes. I'm like, why should I pay taxes? I don't have any kids in school. Well, that's the workforce. That's who's going to be taking care of you when you're old, you know?
Yeah.
You know, we need to take a break, but the thing I have to say about that, the one group that I've never heard saying, why should we pay taxes because we don't have kids, is the LGBT community.
No kidding.
Because we always say, no, we want good schools here. We need to take a break. Kevin, stick with us. We have one more segment to go. You're listening to Lambda Weekly on 89.3 KNON FM. I'm Dave Taffet here in the studio with the late Patty Fink, and we will be back with more right after this.
This is Raphael McDonald from Resource Center Dallas. You're listening to Lambda Weekly on 89.3 KNON FM.
And we're back. Actually, we've been here all along, but the microphones are still are back on now. We're talking to Kevin Jennings. His new book is One Teacher in 10 in the New Millennium. Kevin, I wanted to ask you, you founded GLSEN. How did you do that? Where did the idea come from?
It's a great story, but I'm going to stop for a second just because I have to respond to the ad you just had.
Right.
One of the things I'm proudest of about the One Teacher in 10 book is that the endorsements on the back of the book, one is from Randy Weingarten, who's the president of the American Federation of Teachers and an out lesbian.
She's amazing. I've heard her speak several times. She's amazing.
Right. And the other is from Bob Chase, the immediate past president of the National Education Association, the other big teachers union, who's an out gay man. So it's funny because, you know, there's so much bashing in the unions going on in this country. And the LGBT community should certainly know that in the field of education, it's been the teachers' unions who've been our allies. And they have been headed by out gay people. So I just had to make that comment because I was kind of thrilled to hear an ad by the teachers' union on your show. And I certainly have been very blessed and continue to be blessed with strong support from the teachers' unions here in America. So go back.
I just wanted to say there are 63 radio stations in the Dallas market. We're probably the only one playing that. In fact, I guarantee it.
Yep.
Well, you know, if you are listening to this program and you're anti-union, realize you're throwing our strongest allies at the schools under the bus.
If they're listening to us, they're not anti-union, I'm pretty sure.
Well, you know, it's probably true. So to go back to how GLSEN got started, as I mentioned earlier in the show, I grew up in North Carolina, fundamentalist family, very, very difficult to grow up being gay in the late 70s, early 80s. And I would attempt suicide when I was 16 because I felt hopeless about my future. Fast forward, I become a teacher. I'm 25 years old, and I have a student come out to me in my office. And he says to me, he's thinking of killing himself. So I immediately kind of panic, and I'm like, well, we need to get you counseling. And he said to me words 27 years later, still send a chill down my back. He said, why shouldn't I do it? My life isn't worth saving anyway.
Mm. Oh, that makes me tear up.
And it took me back to barely 10 years before when I had felt the exact same way in high school.
Mm-hmm.
And I made a little promise to myself that whatever I did with my life, I was going to try and help make sure the next generation didn't grow up feeling that way.
Mm-hmm.
So I got up a couple weeks later, and I did an assembly at the school, Concord, Massachusetts, where I came out to the entire school, which actually many years later would lead to the creation of the One Teacher in 10 series, because I had never met an out teacher myself. So I felt like I was walking off a cliff. In 1988, even in Massachusetts, there were no laws protecting people from discrimination based on sexual orientation and gender identity. The only state that had such a law at that time was Wisconsin. So I knew I could be fired. I didn't know what was going to happen. And it was amazing experience because the students kind of mobbed the stage after I finished my talk and were hugging me, and it was wonderful. So a couple of days later, a young woman came into my office and said, I want to start a club to fight homophobia. And quite honestly, I was a little surprised because, A, I didn't have her in my classroom, so I didn't really know her. But I knew who she was because she was the hot freshman girl with the hot senior boyfriend who was always making out outside my classroom, which kind of annoyed the crap out of me. I was like, get a room. You know, so I didn't expect her to be the one who would care about gay issues because she was clearly not gay.
Uh-huh.
And I said to her, I said, why do you care so much about this narrative? And she said, oh, that's easy. My mother's a lesbian, and I'm tired of hearing my family get put down around the school.
Mm.
Now, naive little me in 1988 never thought about the fact that my kids might have gay parents, but here it was. And I said to her, I said, what do you want to call the club? And she said, well, I don't know. You're gay and I'm straight. Let's call it the Gay-Straight Alliance.
Mm.
And that was the first Gay-Straight Alliance student club in the world in 1988 in Concord, Massachusetts.
Membership 2.
Sorry?
Membership 2.
Right. And what started happening was, this is before the Internet. I don't know how people started finding out, but people started finding out that we were doing this work. And they were like, well, can you come to our town and help us? So I created GLSEN in 1990, originally as an all-volunteer group in Boston to help schools in greater Boston address these issues. And the interest grew and grew and grew. And so in 1994, I left teaching, and I became the first executive director of GLSEN.
Hmm.
I'm happy to report that 50% of American high schools now have Gay-Straight Alliances.
Do you know?
That's awesome.
That's amazing.
I spoke at one Gay-Straight Alliance last year in East Dallas. Not a poor neighborhood, but not a well-to-do neighborhood at all. Lower middle-class neighborhood. And in this high school, I'm speaking to the Gay-Straight Alliance, 150 kids there.
Wow. Yeah, it kind of blows my mind. I meet kids now, and they're like, well, I'm running for Gay-Straight Alliance president. I'm like, running? We have trouble getting kids to come to a meeting.
Right.
But, it's competitive.
I know. It's amazing.
Mm-hmm.
There does come the question, though, do you want to look at the glass as half full or half empty? Mm-hmm. 50% of the schools having Gay-Straight Alliances, it's 50% don't.
Right.
And what I worry about is schools in places that really need Gay-Straight Alliances
right.
and don't have them.
Yes.
And too many places continue, even though kids have a legal right to form a Gay-Straight Alliance, too many administrators continue to put up obstacles, continue to put up barriers, continue to give kids a hard time.
Mm-hmm.
And sadly, the places that don't have GSAs are probably the places that need them the most.
Yes.
Yeah, that's for sure.
We've seen that with some kids around here in some of the suburban districts that are pretty horrible to their kids.
And beyond, in Texas, it's just phenomenal.
Yeah.
It's phenomenally bad in some communities.
Well, one thing I would urge every listener who really wants to make a difference to do is a campaign we started at GLSEN many years ago called the Back to School Campaign. We simply asked LGBT adults to write the principal of the high school they went to and say, I was LGBT. This is what it was like for me. I'm curious what you're doing to make it better today.
Mm-hmm.
And we found those letters were so powerful because, you know, many principals are simply unaware of the needs of LGBT students. And when they would get these letters from alums saying, let me tell you how horrible it was for me, a lot of them, it kind of appealed to their conscience and they decided they needed to do something. So some of your listeners, maybe if you have a few minutes, take a few minutes, write that letter, send it to the principal of your old high school, and then call a week later and say, hey, wondering if you got my letter and if I can be of any help to you.
You know, and it's funny that the more I hear these stories, how opposite my high school experience was. None of us were out, but all of my close friends from high school came out in college. We had a teacher who was not out in school, but he lived with mother. And he was the theater teacher. And every stereotype that you can think of, and you would think the school system would have gotten rid of him, and to their credit, they kept him. And we loved him. The straight students did, too. But what a wonderful role model he was. It was nice to have that teacher there, that just somebody that we could relate to.
Yeah, one of the great things about the One Teacher in Ten book is the new edition is how many hopeful stories there are in mm-hmm. it. And what it really boils down to, I think, is this. Students have a great sense, they have a great BS detector. And they like people who are real and people who are authentic. And mm-hmm. when people are not real and authentic, kids don't like them as much.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the great lessons of the book is all of the out teachers report having great relationships with their students. Mm-hmm. Sometimes they have struggles with the administration,
mm-hmm.
but never with the students. And I think it's because two things. First of all, students are struggling with so many issues on their own, and they can relate
mm-hmm.
to somebody who's had a struggle. And number two, this year's high school seniors were born the year Ellen came out.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
They've grown up in a very different world than we all grew up in.
Mm-hmm.
So they are generally more accepting. So, you know, the great thing about the book is it kind of proves that being out makes you a more effective teacher
mm-hmm.
because when you're out, kids can relate to you better.
Mm-hmm.
And I had a funny experience that during my teaching career, I had a group of girls approach me one day and said they wanted to start a club for girls who had been the victims of sexual abuse or rape. I have to admit, I was very surprised because there were many, many, many excellent women teachers at the school. So the first thing I asked was, well, I'll do anything to support you, but I'm just curious why you picked me since I'm a man. And they said, well, you know, we are dealing with something that a lot of people are ashamed of and a lot of people are embarrassed about. And you took something that a lot of people are ashamed of and are embarrassed about. You turned it into something you're proud of. And that's what we want to do.
Hmm.
And
wow.
I thought it was really interesting. The kids were able to make that connection.
Mm-hmm.
That it was about being an authentic human being. It wasn't about being gay or straight.
Mm-hmm.
It was about being an authentic human being. And what they wanted the chance to do was to come out of a different closet. But they wanted to come out of their closet and be honest and truthful about their experiences. And so they came to the gay teacher to help them with that.
Hmm.
And that was one of the most moving moments of my 10 years as a classroom teacher.
That is. It's choking me up now again. Just thinking about that. That's really cool.
When you were a teacher for those 10 years, how many other gay teachers were in your schools?
It was very interesting. There were several.
Mm-hmm.
Most of them chose to remain closeted.
Mm-hmm.
It was a big generation gap. I was 25, as I mentioned, when I came out. It ended up that most of the young teachers who were gay did come out, and most of the teachers in their 40s and 50s did not.
Hmm.
One in 10, David. God.
And I'm really asking how many...
I was challenged at one reading by a gay teacher said, why did you underestimate how many of us there are?
Mm-hmm.
He said, in my experience, a lot of LGBT people are drawn to helping professions,
right.
And we are overrepresented in fields like teaching and nursing. And
I think there's another reason, too, and that's until recently it was very difficult for gays and lesbians to adopt. Texas actually has very good laws to help us adopt or Yeah, we do. Our Child Protective Services.
Foster care and adoption.
Works very well with the gay community because they know who the hell else is going to adopt a lot of these kids, and we do a good job at it. But I think the other reason, until it was easier, you know, there wasn't, you know, a lesbian could get pregnant, but a gay man couldn't hire a surrogate until fairly recently. I think it was that a lot of gay people, that's what they did instead of being parents.
You know, I actually think there's something to that. I did an interview recently because somebody asked me about the impact of marriage equality on young people. And I said, I think what's more interesting, maybe I'm self-absorbed, is the impact of marriage equality on my generation.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it turns out that I'm 52 now, that we're the only generation of LGBT people in history who did not grow up, expect to get married, and have kids.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
The previous generation thought they would grow up, marry people of the opposite sex, and have kids.
Mm-hmm.
The new generation thinks they're going to grow up, marry someone of the same sex, and have kids.
Mm-hmm.
For people of my generation, marriage and kids were, that was the big thing your parents would cry about, that they'd get no grandchildren.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Because being gay automatically meant you have no kids.
Right.
Last year, I officiated a wedding for a kid who was an intern for me when I was at the U.S. Department of Education. He was 22. He was marrying his partner, who was 23, and they're planning to have kids next year.
Hmm.
So, you know, young gay kids are starting to act just like young straight kids. They're getting married and having kids.
Yeah.
And it's really interesting. I like your theory because it speaks to the experience of people my age, which was we didn't think kids were going to be a possibility.
Right.
So,
so
our students kind of became our surrogate children.
And being just a little bit younger than you, Patty Quiet.
actually, I'm about Kevin's age.
Yes, you are.
A little older, actually.
That's the generation I come from, where we couldn't have kids. And a lot of people want to have an effect on kids' lives. They want to see a new generation do well and contribute. And this is a wonderful way to do it as a teacher.
Yeah, no, I mean, I've spent my whole life working at the nexus of education.
Mm-hmm.
And LGBT rights. The most moving event of the One Teacher in 10 and the New Millennium book tour was Wednesday night in Boston, where I did an event where there was a young woman in the audience who I recognized immediately. It was Meredith. It was the girl who'd come in my office in 1988.
Ooh.
And who had started the Gay-Straight Alliance.
Ooh.
Wow.
She's now 42. She's married to a man, has two kids, and really didn't know how incredible the impact she had in the world was. And I had to tell her, you know, 50% of high schools now take straight alliances because of the idea you had when you were 15. And it was just an incredibly moving moment to reconnect with her and to see her and to remind her, you know, you're almost 20 years older now than I was when I was your teacher, which kind of blew her mind.
Right.
You're so old. I was like, I was 25. So it's kind of funny, the perspective of kids. Adults are old no matter how actually old they are.
Right. We are just about out of time. I want to know, did you ever keep up with the kid who had threatened suicide?
Yes, I went. He is now married to a man, and I went to his wedding 3 years ago.
Oh, good.
Awesome.
He's a happy, healthy adult.
Good.
Living in small town Massachusetts.
And the person who said to you from Harvard, your Harvard classmate, who said to you, you went to Harvard and you're a teacher, did you get to see him after you got your White House appointment?
Yeah, I did. And I got to see him on another occasion at the 25th reunion from Harvard. The class votes for the chief marshal, who's the member of the class who's had the most positive impact on the world since graduation. And I was actually the member of the class. They voted for that. So I got
Good. I like
that's
that.
That's awesome.
I like that. Kevin, thank you so much for being with us. We are completely out of time. The book is One Teacher in Ten. Kevin Jennings, the founder of GLSEN, is the editor of the book. Pick it up. They're short stories about teachers. They're great. One after the other, they're just real interesting, going everything from really heartwarming stories to you want to kill somebody. So, Kevin, thank you so much for being with us.
Thanks for having me on today.
Sure. Thanks. The next time you're down in Dallas, please do come join us.
In the
We'd
studio.
Love to have you in the studio.
Oh, that would be great.
Maybe I'll bring Kathy Renner with me.
Oh, do. Thanks so much.
And bye-bye. Next week on our show, we have people from UNT's LGBT Archives Project and from the Dallas Way.
Awesome.